You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 14th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
October 14th, 1947, Chuck Yeager, a World War II fighter pilot, became the first human to fly faster than the speed of sound.
That guy is totally kick-ass.
He's awesome.
He rocks.
I saw him in D.C. once.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell him I said hi.
Going by very, very fast.
He was driving by in a car with Bob Hope.
No way. You're making that up.
The Bob Hope.
Yeah, the Bob Hope. Of course, it was at President Bush's inaugural speech or something.
What? Now I know you're lying.
No, I was living in D.C. at the time. And we were among the millions of people, wherever many people were there. And
I thought I saw you on TV.
As they drove by, a lot of people yelled out, "We love you, Bob," you know, referring to Bob Hope. So I think most of the people in the crowd didn't recognize that Chuck Yeager was sitting next to him.
Yeah.
So the group of people that I was with shouted out, "We love you, Chuck."
Awesome.
Oh, because you were with all the science geeks.
Yeah, right, of course.
Duh.
Steve, did you try to get him for an interview?
Yeah. Did you ask him if he was a skeptic?
The nest wasn't even a twinkle in your eye at that point, was it?
I hadn't even met Perry at that point. It's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Well, no Rebecca tonight because she is on a slow boat to China.
Literally.
Where is she going?
Literally.
Oh, how awesome is that?
It's like a scene out of Indiana Jones or something. You know, this old rickety boat kind of steaming along. You know.
You think that she's having a drinking contest with guns and...
with Sherpas or something?
Yeah.
Maybe.
She could play that role totally. I could totally see her becoming that.
Rebecca leads a very interesting life.
A little bit too interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she's gallivanting around the globe. We're left here to do the podcast. We have an interesting interview coming up later with Dr. Jack Horner, world-famous paleontologist.
Oh, yeah. You betcha.
But first, some news items. NASA apparently is very unhappy with the moon and decided to shoot it.
Shoot the moon.
Right. With a probe.
Two, actually.
Two. Twice.
It's a pretty bittersweet event, I think. But if you're unaware, this past Friday, October 9th, NASA's LCROSS flight mission ended.
Isn't it LaCrosse? Wouldn't you just pronounce that LaCrosse?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
We would, but Bob wouldn't.
I've only ever read it, I guess, so I'm not sure. I'm saying I'm going to go with LCROSS. The flight mission ended this past Friday with a much hyped double collision on the moon, which is pretty cool. Two separate objects were hurled into a permanently shaded southern crater in the hopes of verifying that frozen water exists on the moon, which would, of course, be a huge boon for future lunarians if they ever get there. The idea that NASA heavily promoted, some would say promoted too much, and the public was expecting, was that the LCROSS Shepard satellite would fly through the plume created by the first impact, detecting water, and then it would, of course, impact the moon itself, which would be the second impact. The big disappointment that day was that no plume was kicked up. It was funny. I remember seeing a computer-generated demo the day before, and it showed this beautiful geyser of debris that's called ejecta shooting up spacewards. And I was like, oh, cool. Wow, I can't wait to see it.
Nocturnal ejecta.
Oh, nice. Nice one. The people who got up early the next morning, though, to observe it themselves, some people had their own telescopes. Some people drove out there I'm not sure where they went, to one of the launch pads, I guess, or NASA, where they showed the public videos. They were especially disappointed. The project scientist Anthony Colaprete mentioned one possibility for the poorly performing plume. He said that perhaps the booster – I didn't hear this one. He said perhaps the booster and spacecraft hit the inner wall of the crater at an angle, and because you hit it at an angle, the ejecta kind of went sideways instead of up and out. And he said that luck plays a part in this. He added that we have the data we need to address the questions we have, and that's the bottom line. So I guess that's the important thing, that even though there wasn't this debris cloud that was kicked up, they still say that they have everything that they need, and they're just pouring over tons and tons of this data to really see, you know, exactly what kind of information they could glean from it. Colaprete himself suggested that we probably won't know definitively, at least the public won't, until a December science meeting. So it could be a month or so before we really get any new big news out of this. But that's how science works. It's quirky. You know, you could argue, I guess, that maybe NASA shouldn't have hyped it so much that led to so much disappointment because it didn't, you know, perform, didn't go exactly as planned. But still, it looks like there's some good science in there, and hopefully they'll find some evidence of the water that would be so valuable in the future.
Haven't there been stories before that they've determined there has been frozen water on the moon?
Yeah, other tests have shown that there was, but this would have been some really definitive evidence if that probe could have flown through the vaporized ice. That would have been really interesting.
Bob, from my understanding, though, I never thought that there was ice, chunks of ice or ice in the moon regolith. I thought it was more of like it was a part of the rock. It was like inside the rock where they'd have to like melt down the rock to get the water out.
Well, I think the idea is that essentially the moon is pretty dry. I mean, the rock and regolith, I think, are still considered to be, you know, pretty dry, very little water. They didn't find any clays or anything like that that would indicate a prior presence of water. I think the main idea now is that any water that's there would be from very, very old cometary impacts that would have left ice in these permanently shaded areas that couldn't evaporate away in the heat.
Yeah.
And they've been in shade for millions of years, literally, and just waiting to be to be detected.
And of course, you know, the interest in all this is we want to know how much water is there, so that if we build a base somewhere on the moon, we want to know how much water will we need to bring to sustain the base, and how much water could we mine from the permanent shadow, craters that are creating some permanent shadow.
And the obvious and the uses, I guess, are pretty obvious. For water, obviously. Drinking water for the colonists that could live there, but also fuel as well.
Yeah, you could split it.
You'd split the hydrogen and oxygen.
The hydrogen and oxygen. To oxygen to breathe and hydrogen for fuel. Though, if you're going to use hydrogen for fuel, what are you going to burn it with?
Matches?
That really wouldn't work. I mean, you can't burn it back with the oxygen. That's a net loss of energy.
Yeah, right. But it's just hydrogen you don't have to bring, though.
Right.
You don't have to bring with you.
Yeah, you just have to bring the energy. Or have a source of energy. Another astronomy news item. There's been some news with Saturn's rings. A couple of things, actually. One is that the Spitzer telescope has discovered a new ring around Saturn. This is by far the largest of its rings. It's the ring is tilted 27 degrees from the main ring plane. It starts about 6 million kilometers away from the planet and extends outward another 12 million kilometers. Its vertical height is about 20 times the diameter of Saturn itself. So this is massive. This is a huge, wow, diffuse ring that just has been missed until this point in time.
I can't believe that we could still miss things like that. You know, I mean, right within our own solar system, something that huge.
But it's so subtle and diffuse, Jay. You know? You know, it's kind of, you know, they show these incredible pictures of this red gargantuan ring. But it's like the Jupiter ring. I mean, you really can't – how many pictures of Jupiter do you see where you actually can see the ring around Jupiter? You can't. It's very, very subtle, you know. But still, it's a cool picture, a cool artist conception with the huge red ring.
There's other news about Saturn's rings, though, as well.
Really?
Looking at the rings of Saturn, they have a very curious feature that we've known for a while, that some of the rings are woven like grooves on a record, right? They're not discrete concentric rings. They actually sort of blend
band
together.
Around each other. Yeah.
Right. Just like
braided,
like, more braided, more like the grooves of a record, exactly. Huh. And this is a very curious feature. But recent Cassini studies of Saturn's rings have shown that this feature is actually more widespread throughout the ring system than was previously thought, and that this could mean that around 25 years ago, there was something dramatic happened that disrupted the ring system around Saturn, but it was missed by any observations at the time. So whatever happened 25 years ago, we missed it. We didn't pick it up in any of our telescopes, and we're not really
25.
Sure what this mystery event might have been. But they're saying the ring system of Saturn was perturbed about 25 years ago by something.
Holy crap! How did we miss that?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So it's just, an inference at this point, but there's definitely some lots of complex structure in the rings that's really challenging our theoretical models about how they form.
Isn't there something very noble looking about a ring around a planet?
There is. It's a very iconic image.
Yeah.
Yes.
And enjoy them while you can. Because eventually the rings of Saturn won't be there, so enjoy them while you can.
Yeah. So Bob, during my hyper extended lifespan, I guess I'll be able to enjoy the rings of Saturn for what, another
10 million years?
10 million years or so.
That's right. Your head on that robot body 10 million years from now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember when they were ring.
I remember when Bob told me. No, I'm not going to actually have an old man voice 10 million years in the future. It'll be more like this.
Yes, I remember.
When Bob told me the rings will one day not be there.
You'll sound like a 1950s robot, right?
Yep.
Jay, tell us about HypnoCat.
Well, of course, all of you guys have heard about hypnosis.
Yes.
I'm curious to ask all of you. And Evan, why don't you give us a quick definition of what you think hypnosis is?
It is the it's your subconscious sort of being brought forth and taking over your more active conscious. Does
Bob,
that make sense?
What do you think it is?
I remember hearing a hypnotist say that all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. But I think if I had to bottom line it, it's just a very highly suggestible state of mind.
Steve, how would you define it?
It's not really clear exactly just neurologically if it is actually a discrete state or not. It probably isn't. I think the closest we have is what Bob said, a state in which someone is hyper suggestible.
When I asked myself this question before I started reading about this article, what I'm about to explain to you guys, I kind of answered it more the way Evan did. I was like, hypnosis. Yeah, it's kind of like your subconscious mind. And the fact is, I read a lot of stuff about it. I was actually hoping that you would have a much more defined answer as a neurologist, but really nobody really quite understands what it is other than people enter a more suggestible state, they're relaxed, and they're more focused on the inside than the outside, meaning that they're not really – they're becoming less aware of what's around them and more aware of themselves.
Mm-hmm. But that's a good word. I think it is a matter of focus. It certainly isn't – it's not a trance. It's probably not a discrete neurological state. It's not like dreaming or waking dreams versus consciousness or even drowsiness. I think it's just the way people are focusing their thoughts and their attention. And certainly there's a huge variability in susceptibility to it. I think there is a lot of belief that it's the individual who's being hypnotized doing all the hard work, right? I mean, It has to do with them, not the hypnotist. The hypnotist is not really doing anything except suggesting to somebody that they are in this state.
It was originally defined by the person who discovered it, I guess would be the right way, as sleep of the nervous system, which seems to be very inaccurate today, but at the time, that's probably what they thought was happening. So anyway, let me get on to why I asked all this. So recently, a reporter named Chris Jackson, who hosts the show Inside Out in the UK, surprisingly successfully registered his cat named George with three prominent hypnosis organizations in the UK: the British Board of Neuro-Linguistic Programming, the United Fellowship of Hypnotherapists, and the Professional Hypnotherapy Practitioner Association. He did this by – came up with an organization called the Society of Certified Advanced Mind Therapists, and he claimed that his cat belonged to this fake organization. They all accepted the certificate that he sent them from the fake organization, and his cat, George, became a member of these three organizations, which basically proves that it's very easy to get credentials as a hypnotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
The net effect of all this was showing that, this isn't really, I don't know, how would you put this? It's not a legitimate science. It's not a legitimate practice.
Well, this doesn't say anything about hypnosis itself, right? This is only really an investigation of the regulation of hypnosis as a standard of care. You have the self-regulation, right, of hypnosis by these societies, by these groups.
Right.
What it says is they're not vetting their members. You send them the check for however much money it costs, and they'll, you get certified.
But and, Steve, doesn't that smack of, you know, becoming certified as a homeopath or any, you know, it's like...
I do think that these two things tend to go hand in hand, you know, this sort of loose criteria for joining an organization or getting certified and not and having low standards of evidence and science within the field itself. I think, you know, low standards in, but in these two areas go hand in hand, but they are distinct. And it doesn't necessarily mean that hypnosis is not legitimate. I think that there's a lot of organizations using hypnosis therapeutically and going way beyond what the evidence really supports in terms of the claims that they're making. And then there are those who go beyond just exaggerating the claims to pure pseudoscience, like using hypnosis for past life regression therapy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would say as a skeptic, I have a more negative connotation towards it just because we can't show why and what it is, right? We can't actually prove neurologically that something is occurring, right? I would have definitely read that today if that had been taking place, I believe. And you know, the fact that you're a neurologist, Steve, and you're saying, hey, you know, we don't know exactly what it is. I mean, you'd figure there'd be some type of plausibility here. You know, and you see a lot of things on the internet, like these people, like, you know, like the more showmanship level stuff where these guys, like, have people go around the stage acting like chickens and doing stupid
stuff.
Well, that's
stage hypnotism, which has nothing to do with therapeutic hypnotism.
But, you know, I've heard of people going to get hypnotized to lose weight.
Smoking. Smoking.
All of these.
Curb habits and so forth.
Yeah, there's no evidence for that, for those applications.
Right.
So my question to you then, Steve, is what's it for? What would we use it for?
You know, exactly. I mean, I don't think that there are really any scientifically proven, you know, therapeutic applications of hypnosis.
Not even like a relaxation technique?
That's exactly what I was going to say. But I think beyond just relaxation. And then you're just talking about another term for relaxation, right?
Right. But you can charge a lot more money being a hypnotherapist than a relaxation specialist.
Right.
All right, Steve, would you draw any parallels between self-hypnosis and transcendental meditation?
Well, I think that there are many systems like certain kinds of hypnosis, transcendental meditation, biofeedback, yoga, that, although yoga has a physical component to it as well, that essentially are elaborate, ritualized versions of relaxation. And in the end, what the studies have demonstrated for these types of things is that they have the benefits that you would expect from relaxation. And not really anything beyond that. Maybe it might help some people to relax, but again, in the final analysis, they're just elaborate forms of just getting somebody to take a break from their busy day and focus their attention elsewhere, de-stress and relax. That's
by
it.
Any other name,
but you call it transcendental meditation, and you know it sort of has an implication to it that goes beyond that. Same thing for hypnosis. You do anything to people who want to quit smoking, and a certain percentage of them are going to quit. And it's probably the same people who are going to quit no matter what you do. The ritual doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that there's something value added to the ritual of hypnosis. You know,
not even a placebo effect kind of benefit.
But then how do you separate a placebo effect from the people who are going to quit anyway? I mean,
that is my point, right?
That's what I'm saying. It's just
indistinguishable.
It was interesting for me to start doing research on this article and on hypnosis because I found right away that I definitely had an opinion already about it, obviously, right? I mean, it's part of our culture. I've already come to some conclusions about it, mostly unconsciously, I'd say, just, you know.
Jay, last week we were having dinner and I was showing you my pocket watch and I said, you're interested in hypnotherapy and learning more about it.
I don't remember that.
No. Well,
so I gave it another try. Like I hit the reset button and said, okay, I'm gonna do all this research again. I'm going to read about it and let my opinion be changed. Okay,
yeah.
Let me see what I find today. And I did it. I reread all this stuff I'm doing this research and I found that there was no conclusive evidence either way. I couldn't find anything that I felt had any weight to it.
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of studies that show it lowers blood pressure and it does it, but it's all the same thing. It's like, yeah, pretty much anything that gets you to relax will have those same kind of effects. But there are organizations dedicated to hypnosis as a therapeutic modality They gain legitimacy by getting licensure and forming institutes and certifying people. And again, this I think shows that with a lot of these kind of things, the self-regulation can be pretty lax.
Yeah.
My only problem with the stunt that this journalist pulled is that he didn't use his pet toad, because it would have been far better to have Hypno-Toad.
The Hypno-Toad.
And Hypno-Cat.
Any relation to the Hypnocampus?
That's Hippocampus. There's no N.
God,
and what happens, unfortunately, all too readily, is that states or governments will license a profession and then hand over regulation to the profession itself, right? Basically saying, you regulate yourselves. You know, we'll license you, and you have to jump through these hoops, which basically means you have to pay us money. And it becomes a method of discouraging competition, but not really a method for quality control, which is always how it's sold. And this is just one piece of evidence that it really isn't serving the purpose of quality control that the proponents sell it as, right? Hypnocat.
Yeah.
One more quick news item before we go on to a few questions. We've been keeping you up to date on Simon Singh's legal wranglings with the British Chiropractic Association. One small update, good news. You know, Simon had previously appealed the decision, or actually asked for permission to appeal the judge's decision that he would have to defend his case on the basis of the interpretation that his criticism of the British Chiropractic Association, that they happily promote bogus therapies, means that all of the members of the British Chiropractic Association do not believe their own claims, that they're consciously committing fraud, which was not what he intended and is almost an impossible standard to prove. He previously asked for permission to appeal that decision. He was turned down. He appealed that decision and was recently given permission to appeal by Lord... Is that really the guy's name? Lord Justice
no.
Laws?
No, that can't be right.
That's got to be a title. This is according to Sense About Science, who has again been following this very closely. They report that this morning at the Royal Courts of Justice, Simon Singh was granted leave to appeal the preliminary ruling on meaning in his libel case with the BCA. In his judgment, Lord Justice Laws said there is no dispute that Simon's original article is in the public interest, with no suspicion of malice, and there is no question of good faith. Good, that's excellent. But though. Lord Justice Laws, is that really that guy's name?
Sounds like a superhero, doesn't he?
that's a Stanley Kubrick name.
You think
you know?
His first name is Justice? Come on.
Right?
Justice
Laws. Wasn't that Judge Dredd's real name?
Judge Dredd.
Major Kong and...
Major Payne.
Remember?
Could you think about how pompous that guy is? I'm Lord Justice Laws!
Maybe he speaks with such a heavy accent that nobody can really understand what he's saying, and it's just as close as they can get.
Okay, I think Lord Justice is the title, but the guy's name is John Laws.
Ah.
Sir John Laws.
Oh, my God.
Lord Justice Laws. Excellent.
Okay. Interesting.
Wow.
Didn't consider that permutation.
That's pretty interesting.
No, I didn't either. That's good.
Oh. I'll have to call Dr. Killpatient.
Dr. Killpatient, right. Well, let's go on to a few questions. Question number one comes from David Lingard from London, England.
How long did he linger?
Not long. then David writes, okay, not exactly faster than light travel, but I thought this quite interesting nevertheless. Earth to Mars in 39 days? Please, please, please let this be true. Given the rogues and my own geekness concerning such subjects, I thought this one might be an interesting point of discussion. Personally, I suspect the devil will be in the details, and several years of proving lay ahead, but every day the red planet is getting closer and cheaper. P.S. Keep up the good work. I'll keep my eye out for the Bostonian in London.
Do that.
He means Rebecca.
He means Rebecca. That's
yes.
Right. That's correct.
I know what he
means. Bostonian in London. It's a song in there somewhere. So, Bob, tell us about this new fancy plasma rocket.
Wait, yeah, Steve.
Yeah, Bob, what'd you invent?
Steve.
What?
Oh.
He wrote David Lingard, London, England, and then he wrote Governor.
Governor.
Hello, Governor.
Should have written,
Call Blimey. Call Blimey,
Governor. Right. But.
So, David, thank you for the question. You're right. It's pretty interesting. The bottom line, the likelihood of getting to Mars in 39 days using this technology seems very good.
That's all you got to say? That's it?
Oh, there you have it.
There you have it, David.
That's all I got. All right, I'll give a few more details.
All right.
To put that into perspective, though, going to Mars using conventional chemical rockets would take – now, I've heard lots of different numbers. I came across 260 days. I came across 130 days was the best I could see if somehow you figured out the high-speed transfer orbits. So regardless, this is a huge, huge improvement. 39 days compared to, say, 200 days with conventional technology. That's very, very good. It really is a big deal and pretty exciting. One reason is that space travel is boring. You know, it's not like Star Trek or other popular science fiction. There's no stars flying by or cool, colorful wormhole tunnels.
Or green, scantily clad women.
Oh, yes. Oh. Well, you could kind of wing that one.
You could bring them with you.
I guess you could.
But think about it. You know, the ships that we would send are small. You know, it wouldn't be like they'd have a large living space or whatever. Imagine being on a cooped up with a few people for 200 days.
You know what would really help? I've never come across this, but isn't it pretty obvious that virtual reality would be the way to deal with that crushing feeling that you'd have on there?
I mean, holodeck.
But worse than that, that's just, you know, ennui is nothing compared to exposure to radiation and microgravity, which are, you know, pretty much debilitating at best and deadly at worst. So anything that reduces the transit time is a really, really good thing. But the technology itself is pretty interesting. Do you guys remember 10 years ago, Deep Space One was a probe they sent into space? Yep. The test, it was like a test bed for a suite of technologies, including an ion engine. Well, this is very similar. Yeah. This new engine that we're talking about here is very similar to that Deep Space One ion energy that David was referencing. This specifically, it's called the Vasimir engine, which is short for Variable Specific Impulse Magnetoplasma Rocket. These engines use radio waves to heat gases like hydrogen or argon, which creates a plasma. Now, you guys all know what plasma is by now, right? It's a material that when
state
it's heated,
of matter.
It's heated, right. It's the most common state of matter. It's heated so much that the electrons just kind of say, hasta la vista, they kind of fly away. So you got this particle soup of positive nucleons and negative electrons. The sun is made of plasma. It's the most abundant form of matter, except for dark matter, of course.
Yeah.
Not including dark matter.
It's the most common state of baryonic matter, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's something everybody should kind of be aware of, I think. Now, the plasma itself, once it's generated, it's kind of contained in a magnetic field, kind of like a fusion reactor, a tokamak reactor that they've been working on for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 decades now. They use a magnetic field to accelerate the plasma. Now, the acceleration itself is caused by the Lorentz force. Look that one up. It's pretty interesting. So the plasma gets ejected at the back of the ship at a very high velocity, creating forward thrust for the ship. So that's kind of – that's, you know, in a nutshell, very high level how it works. There's so many complicated bits to it, though, that I can't even – most of it I can't even understand. But that's pretty much how it works. But a key thing here, if you remember the acronym – Vasimir, a variable specific impulse. Specific impulse is a key concept in rocket propulsion. Basically, specific impulse describes how propellant efficient an engine is. It's like miles per gallon or liters per kilometer, if you're all metric, for a car. The higher the specific impulse, the less propellant that you're needed to gain the momentum you want. So this is a very, very important bit of information about rockets. It you could basically equate it to how fast the propellant is exiting the back of the ship. It's kind of related to that.
All right, so Bob, this thing is highly efficient engine.
Right, it's a highly efficient engine. For a comparison, a chemical rocket will have a specific impulse of less than 500 seconds, whereas this Vasimir engine could have a specific impulse of 6,000 seconds or more. So clearly the velocity of the propellant coming out is much, much higher than a chemical rocket.
Yeah, and the faster you get your propellant going, the less of it you need.
Exactly. That's the key right there. But just because it's energy efficient, this doesn't mean that it's energy efficient, though. It's not like a green rocket or anything like that, because a lot of times you need more power to support your higher fuel efficiency.
Yeah.
So it's not a measure of fuel efficiency.
It's propellant efficiency, right? It's really propellant efficiency, not so much fuel efficiency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How long until we have this freak?
Well, Jay, you're talking Vasimir or just ion engine in general? We've had the ion engines for a while. Vasimir, this was a test bed. This was the first plasma engine to break 200 kilowatt barrier. So it was a huge, huge milestone for these people. And it was a really great thing that they did. And now it's this milestone. Now that this is met, they're going to go to the space station, which is awesome, awesome news. They have a contract with NASA to change the thrusters because it just saves so much fuel. The space station uses like 7.5 tons of chemical rocket propellant for station keeping, to make sure that you're not getting lower, closer to the atmosphere, because atmospheric drag is always trying to pull the station down. They have to use chemical conventional rockets to boost their orbit. If they use this stuff, they would only use like 0.3 tons. So they'll save millions and millions of dollars just by using this to help with their orbit.
Do one more question. This one comes from Eric Weiss in Austin, Texas. And Eric writes, I am sure by now you have all heard of this man who has appeared in hundreds of people's dreams. And he gives a link to thisman.org. I've actually never heard of this man.
Nor had I. Rightfully so. Right? What was there to know? But, well, there's a little history here, according to this. So, as the title reads, ever dream about this man? Every night throughout the world, hundreds of people dream about this face. And they show a face, a picture, a sketch drawing of a man.
It's kind of an ugly guy with a unibrow and low-set ears and a weird mouth.
And a male pattern baldness kind of thing going on. And
A little creepy looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, definitely off.
So.
Little Twin Peaks kind of feel to him. You know?
It looks like the head of what a hobbit would look like.
According to this website, it was January 2006 in New York City, where the patient of a well-known psychiatrist draws the face of a man that had been repeatedly appearing in her dreams. In more than one occasion, the man had given her advice on her private life. The woman swears she'd never met the man before in her life, and that portrait lies forgotten on the psychiatrist's desk for a few days, until one day another patient happens by and recognizes the drawing, the face, and says, oh, I'm often visited by that man in my dream as well. So the psychiatrist decides to send the portrait to other colleagues, apparently all over the world, and they all have patients that have recognized this face as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, that story sounds like total BS.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's so contrived. You know, the woman drew a picture of the guy in her dream. Okay, maybe. And then the psychiatrist let it hang out on his desk for another client to see. Not impossible, but certainly not appropriate. And it all sounds contrived. I just don't buy that story.
I don't buy it either. And then, of course, the snowball effect. And over from 2006 until today, now 2,000 people or more have claimed they've seen this exact face in their dreams. Los Angeles, people from Berlin, San Paulo, Tehran.
I mean, first of all, with the amount of dreams that people have a night and the amount of people out there, it isn't that much of a coincidence.
Right.
Well, there's some prevailing theories as to what's going on here, why people all over the globe are reportedly seeing this face, this man, in their dreams. So there's the archetype theory, according to Carl Jung's psychoanalytic theory. This man is an archetype image belonging to the collective unconscious that can surface in times of hardship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And religious theory, this is the image of the creator, and it's the form in which God manifests himself today. In the 70s, it was George Burns, but apparently in 2006 to 2009, it's this hobbit-looking fellow. And they say the most interesting one is the dream surfer theory, which has the lowest scientific credibility. Yeah, none of these have scientific credibility, but that's another point. According to this dream surfer theory, the man is a real person who can enter people's dreams by means of specific psychological skills.
Just like SpongeBob.
Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Is that how SpongeBob
That was a SpongeBob episode.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's about the level we're dealing with here. Or how about this is a stupid belief that is spread by the internet theory. This is a meme. That's all. That's it. As Jay said, you know, we lots of people having lots of dreams, you know, finding a common thread is not a big deal. And then you have retrofitting and, you know, it's a belief that takes on a life of its own. That's all. We don't need any more of a hypothesis than that. We could test that hypothesis, and maybe we should actually do this. We could try to start our own dream meme, if you will, and see if we can get it to take off. See if we come up with some random stupid picture and see how many people eventually will report that they've seen it in their dreams.
Steve, there's enough people in the world. That guy exists. There's a dude out there that looks just like that guy.
Probably. 6.7 billion people. There's probably somebody out there who looks a lot like that guy. We should find him.
We should find him.
Imagine that guy like... Yeah, oh, my God. That'd be awesome. You have his convention, and you bring the guy in, and those 2,000 people that dreamt of him are like, oh, my God, it's the guy.
It's this
like,
man. Right.
Totally scams him.
The person who created this site, it's been traced back to this person, Andrea Natella, from Italy. And he's supposedly a guerrilla marketeer. So this is supposedly some sort of just generic viral campaign for the internet.
Yeah, right.
And according to this one website, he is, quote, a sociologist specializing in marketing. And he once wrote an article about the origins of the subversive use of the hoax. And how to, you know, and how to maximize its potential. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think my hypothesis is looking very good.
Yeah, I'd say so.
That's interesting.
So, nothing going on here, but I mean, this is one of the...
So he's doing the experiment I just proposed. That's what this is.
That's good work. I mean, this is really one of the more stupid things I've come across recently.
It's kind of a fun internet thing.
Yeah, it is, but at the same time, you know, what a waste. It's like a big waste of time, basically. Like, can't we do something else here?
Well, I guess we should just go on to our interview then. We are talking now with Dr. Jack Horner. Dr. Horner, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hello.
And Dr. Horner is a world-famous paleontologist specializing in dinosaurs. He is the author of many books, including his most recent book, How to Build a Dinosaur, Extinction Doesn't Have to Be Forever. And you live and work primarily at Montana State University. There's a lot to talk to you about, but the news item that prompted us contacting you for this interview was a National Geographic article claiming that as many as a third of dinosaur species never existed. Can you tell us about that?
Well, my latest research with a number of different colleagues, including Mark Goodwin in Berkeley and one of my graduate students, John Scanella, and one of my staff members, Alan Lamb, focuses on looking at dinosaur ontogeny, basically the growth of dinosaurs. Many years ago, paleontologist named Peter Dodson looked at a bunch of duckbill dinosaurs and did kind of a statistical analysis of them and came to the conclusion that some species were actually juveniles of some other animals that had been named. So, but over the years, that was back in the 1970s, and then over the years, people sort of forgot that study. And one of the reasons they forgot it was that in order to do a study like that, you have to have lots and lots and lots of specimens from one formation. And so back in the year 2000, or 1999, I started a project in the Hell Creek Formation in Montana here to collect as much material as possible from a formation. In other words, go out and literally collect everything. And we've been doing that for 11 years now. And we've got an enormous collection of triceratops and T-Rex and duckbill dinosaurs and all sorts of things, and are now able to see ontogenies. For instance, we got 60 new skulls of triceratops and now have juveniles for the first time and have a whole ontogenetic series so that we can see the changes that Triceratops undergoes, and it goes through pretty severe changes. I mean, drastic ones. And in fact, going from juveniles with horns that curve backwards to adults that horns curve forward, all the way up to the dinosaur Torosaurus. We now have evidence that Torosaurus and Triceratops are the same animal.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I remember seeing I'm near New Haven, so I think there's some Torosaurus specimens at the Peabody.
Exactly. They are adult triceratops.
They're adult triceratops.
Yep.
The same you think is true of T-Rex. Now, because we had recently been discussing recently discovered species like Nanotyrannus and also
right.
Raptorex.
Right.
Is it your contention that these are also different stages of T-Rex development?
Well, Nanotyrannus certainly is. We've got pretty good evidence of that. The Nanotyrannus was named basically, it's a small tyrannosaur, and it was given a different name because it has 17 teeth in its jaws, and T-Rex has 12, and it was always known that dinosaurs either kept the same number of teeth or they got more teeth as they grew up, and no dinosaur ever lost teeth, but we now have intermediates between Nanotyrannus and Tyrannosaurus that show that T-Rex lost teeth as it grew up.
So as they get bigger, they have fewer teeth.
That's correct. There are fewer big teeth. So they start out with blade-shaped teeth, and then they start losing teeth, and the new teeth that they gain actually are bigger, stouter, bone-crushing teeth. So Tyrannosaurs, and then Pachycephalosaurus is the newest one we've looked at, and we've been able to synonymize Dracorex, Stygimoloch, and Pachycephalosaurus all into one species.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the controversy in terms for this view comes from the fact that this presupposes a more dramatic morphological change in these dinosaur groups as they age than we generally find elsewhere in the animal kingdom. Do you think that's fair?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. If you've ever seen a cassowary, grows up almost full grown, and then a big old crest sprouts on top of its head in the last 20% of its growth.
But still, this is, while extremely interesting, controversy. I love genuine, friendly controversies within science, because it really tells you, and I think as you have said, the process is more important than the answer. And this
That's
really
right.
reveals the process of science. I've been also reading some of the articles by Robert Baker, who I think takes the other point of view, like specifically with Pachycephalosaurus. He contends that he has a specimen of a juvenile Pachycephalosaurus that is different than either Dracorex or Stygimoloch. So where does that controversy stand?
Well, first off, it hasn't been published, so scientifically I can't do anything with it. I mean, he's going to have to, after our paper comes out, then he's going to have to publish that to see if he can falsify our hypothesis. I can't, if he has something in his basement that he's not letting anyone see, and you're just telling people he has it, that doesn't do me any good whatsoever. I haven't seen it.
I see. So that's not in the literature yet.
But just for your information, we do have an ontogenetic series of Pachycephalosaurus, just like we do of Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus. I mean, we're not just guessing. That's the cool thing about this 11-year study, is that we've got a lot of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We can see, we've got the bumps, the little nodes on the back of a juvenile Pachycephalosaurus that you can just follow as they get big, turn into big spikes, and then reduce back down to bumps again.
Okay.
It's interesting. One of the interesting things is that all the Stygimoloch or Dracorex spikes that we have found, we haven't found any two of them that are actually the same length.
So there's a lot of variability there anyway.
Exactly. And it all matches an ontogenetic series. In other words, the big ones and the little ones are on various different sizes of skulls.
And what about Dr. Baker's point that in order to interpret that ontologically as different stages of growth, say for the Pachycephalosaurus, that would require the head spikes to dramatically reduce in size as they got older. And he says that there's just no precedent for that, that generally speaking, horns, once they appear, they only get bigger. Obviously, you take the other point of view, but what would your answer to that be?
Well, just as an example, before I answer that question, let me just tell you about Triceratops. Horned dinosaurs are the sister group to Pachycephalosaurus. Horned dinosaurs and dome-headed dinosaurs are in a group, the Marginocephalia. In other words, they're sister taxa, basically. Mm-hmm. Triceratops does the same thing. On the edge of its frill, it grows these very large triangular bones that are called epioccipitals. And they start out little triangles, and they grow to big triangles. And then as the animal continues to mature, those big triangles reduce back down and flatten out against the frill. Mm-hmm. And we have, like I said, 60 skulls. I mean, we have an incredible ontogenetic series showing that these triangular bones reduce in size. Mm-hmm. Now, Marginocephalian, other groups, are the pachycephalosaurs, and we're saying that they basically do the same thing. Here are spikes on the back of the skull muscles and behind the parietals that do exactly the same thing. They get longer, and then they get shorter. And we cut these things. We've done the histology on them. We've done the histology on the domes. And indeed, during the initial phases, those spikes are growing, and they show fast-growing bone, and then it comes to a halt. And then we see resorption, bone resorption, the bone actually getting smaller.
Now, are there histological markers of that?
Yep. Yeah, we have great images of it. And we have a paper that is in press right now in PLOS One that's due out any day.
So do you think that the National Geographic headline about a third of dinosaur species may be combined in this way, do you think that's fair and accurate?
I think so. I wouldn't have said it otherwise.
Okay. Oh, that quote is specifically from you?
Yeah.
Okay. And let's get back to T-Rex for a little bit. You mentioned Nanotyrannus. Have you had a chance to form an opinion about Raptor Rex?
Well, Raptor Rex certainly... They claim it's from early Cretaceous. I'm a little skeptical about that, but even whether it is or it isn't doesn't matter. Raptor Rex definitely has juvenile characteristics of a tyrannosaur. It's got big eyes, and they cut the bones. In fact, we did the bone histology here. Our lab did it, and I've seen the thing. I mean, it looks to me like juvenile bone.
Mm-hmm. So it may be a juvenile of something, if not the later T-Rex species and you think maybe a related species, or you're still not really buying
it's certainly a juvenile tyrannosaur of some sort. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether they have the geology correct. As far as I know, I mean, they didn't collect it. It was apparently already collected, and they guessed on the formation that came based on some fish vertebrae.
Yeah. For our audience, can you tell us what would the process be? Let's say you reach consensus among dinosaur paleontologists that, okay, Raptor Rex is a juvenile T-Rex. What's the process then to change the naming convention, to basically to remove species status from it and get rid of that taxonomical designation?
Oh, Raptor Rex. I don't know that Raptor Rex is the one you want to do.
Or Nanotyrannus.
We think that Nanotyrannus is a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Therefore, it's just plain synonymized. Tyrannosaurus Rex was named first, and therefore Nanotyrannus will just be synonymized with T-Rex.
But who ultimately makes that decision? Is there a body within paleontology that would ultimately make it official, like Nanotyrannus is now synonymized?
Well, when it's written in the paper, then it becomes official.
Okay.
And the paper that we have done on, that Mark Goodwin and I have coming out in PLOS One on synonymizing Pachycephalosaurus, Digimoloch, and Dracorex does just that. It synonymizes all of them. You know, and these are testable hypotheses. All someone has to do is find Digimoloch, an animal, a skull with spikes and as big as Pachycephalosaurus. I mean, you know, that's pretty easy to do. Theoretically, it's possible to falsify that hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Same goes with Nanotyrannus and Triceratops and Torosaurus.
Right. We just need more specimens, basically.
So, histologically, Torosaurus, all the Torosaurus specimens are all mature, and they all have, every one that we've cut has a histology that shows that they are more mature than any specimen of Triceratops.
Mm-hmm. Would they have a chance to look at some of the fossils that you have, or would they have to pretty much dig up their own and do it themselves?
Yeah, they can come look at ours as soon as our papers are published.
Right.
Open for the public, or open for scientific research. Other people can come look at our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We have researchers in every day.
Let's turn a little bit to another controversy about whether or not T-Rex was a predator or a scavenger.
I hope you remember. I hope you recall. I haven't really published anything on that.
Okay.
I use that as a way to teach little kids not to come to preconceived ideas.
I see.
In other words, I use it as just a way to show that you shouldn't start with a preconceived idea that T-Rex is one or the other, that you should have evidence,
mm-hmm.
that you need physical evidence before you can make a hypothesis. And so when people say that T-Rex is a predator, but they don't really have any reason, that is just bad science.
And you have obviously been one of the modern paleontologists who's, I think, on the forefront of popularizing the science of paleontology to the public, obviously. And so, and I know you've said in other interviews that you think that your academic work and popularizing your work are just one and the same thing, which we heartily endorse that approach among working scientists. So tell us about some of the outreach you've done, because I agree with you that, dinosaurs are sexy. All kids love dinosaurs. It's a great opportunity to teach kids about the process of science. So how have you used dinosaur paleontology to teach kids about science?
Well, I'm in the education business, so that's exactly what I do. I do my best to keep my science at a very high level, publish in the best journals there are, peer-reviewed journals, blind peer-reviewed journals, and then also publish for kids in popular places, and write books for kids, and write books just for the general population as well. But it's all based on the science.
And, do you think that, how much of an impact do you think that a working scientist can have popularizing science compared to just the overall state of science education in this country?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I think you probably could answer that question better than I could.
Well, it's kind of just opening the door to do you have an opinion about what's wrong with science education, or if there's anything wrong and what we need to do about it?
Well, obviously, there's lots wrong with science education. We don't teach kids to think. We don't teach kids to figure problems out. We just give them a bunch of answers.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think that would be easy to fix, but then I guess you have to. If you're going to do it that way, you have to teach teachers how to think.
Yeah, there seems to be a disconnect between those who are working scientists and know how to popularize how to think like a scientist and the education community. Not certainly universally. I know some science teachers who do a good job, but I think there aren't enough of them out there, right? And systemically,
There are a lot of people, a lot of science teachers that are very good science teachers, but I think we're failing at the university level. Education departments are always looked down upon by science departments, and therefore we do a poor job of teaching our educators, and I think that needs to change. I think it's our fault. I think it's the scientists' fault for not teaching teachers better.
So what steps do you think we need to take to fix that?
Get more scientists in over to the education departments. Because people in education departments aren't necessarily going to come to science departments.
You think it's just a problem of culture among working scientists?
Yep, absolutely.
My sense is that maybe it's getting a little better. And I know there are other famous science popularizers like Carl Sagan who also sort of felt that educating the public about science was looked down upon by his colleagues. Do you ever feel the same kind of syndrome that you're looked down upon by any of your colleagues because you're writing books for the popular culture? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, there was a little of that back in the earlier days, but I think it's changing considerably. The National Science Foundation is very much into public outreach now,
mm-hmm.
and they put quite a bit of money in. In fact, when you get a National Science Foundation grant to do something, there's always an educational component attached to it. So I think it is changing, but it's changing very slowly.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about your new book, How to Build a Dinosaur? We've actually talked about this overall concept, not in the context of your book, but just the concept of building a dinosaur, not necessarily in the Jurassic Park mode, but just by manipulating genetics. So Why don't you tell us about what you discuss in the book?
Well, it's, you know, the book is about a lot of different things. It starts out in the Hell Creek Formation and the Hell Creek Project and goes into a lot of the work that Mary Schweitzer has been doing, the discovery of soft tissues and proteins. And then and basically, you know, sort of comes to the conclusion that if you're going to make a dinosaur, that's not the way to do it because we can't get DNA, mm-hmm. at least not so far, and the proteins we're getting aren't going to help us. So I sort of come about it in a different way and just talk about, you know, the fact that since dinosaurs gave rise to birds, we could theoretically just retro-engineer a bird, but we don't really know how to do that either. Basically, the book is about creating a chickenosaurus and basically doing it the very easiest way, and that is to manipulate switches, genetic switches, during embryogenesis. In other words, as a bird is developing in its egg, actually flip the switches that would cause certain things to happen. For instance, there's a tail that begins to develop in a bird, and it has several vertebrae. And then a gene kicks on and basically resorbs the tail and fuses it into the pygostyle and the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens in the wing. If you watch the embryo developing, the early bird actually has five fingers. And then a gene takes out two of them, leaving it with three fingers that eventually fuse together to make the wing. So really, to maintain at least a couple of what we would consider dinosaurian characteristics, if we can find the gene that takes out the tail and the gene that fuses those three fingers together, just those two genetic switches, we could hatch a bird with a long tail and hands rather than wings. And already have found the gene for teeth, so, mm-hmm. so right. You know, we could make a bird with a tail and arms and hands and teeth. I mean, that gives us three of the characteristics that we generally think of as being dinosaurian rather than bird.
This is primarily the work of Hans Larsen, right? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, the work on the tail and the hands, yes. That's work that I have supported that Hans is doing in his lab.
But are there others working on it as well?
Well, there are. There are some people in Singapore working on it, and there are people at the University of Wisconsin that are involved in some of it. You know, anybody that has a genetics lab could do it. I just think it's a cool way to show how evolution works.
Right.
I wonder what the creationists would say with when they finally meet a chickenosaurus.
Well, that's going to be a good question, isn't it? It's going to be interesting to have them explain how you can end up with a chicken with a long tail and hands and teeth.
I don't think they'll have much of a problem. They seem to be pretty good about dismissing any inconvenient evidence. They'll just say it was some laboratory monster created by a mad scientist, right?
Well, the cool thing is you don't have to add anything to the chicken in order to get it to do that.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, you're not changing any genes. You're just changing the expression of the genes, the timing, and that's all you got to do.
Yeah.
What research project are you working on right now?
Well, I'm still working on these ontogenies. I mean, we have, you know, we've got a lot of, besides looking at these massive collections that we have got to look at ontogenies, we also, you know, we've got everything tied into stratigraphy, so we're also beginning to see some phylogenetic signals, some evidence of evolution within the formations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Horner, this has been a fascinating interview. We love talking with working scientists about their work, and especially those who take the time to popularize it. So thanks for spending some time with us.
You're very welcome.
Have a good
day. Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Bob is and Jay is.
Mm-hmm. All right, here we go. Item number one, scientists discover the first recorded instance of a spider species that is predominantly herbivorous. Item number two, researchers have developed a new kind of battery for an all-electric car that can be recharged as quickly as filling a tank of gas. And item number three, scientists have discovered a plant species that grows exclusively in the flesh of living animals. Jay, I would like for you to go first.
I will. So scientists found a spider that is mostly an herbivore. That's interesting. Definitely, it's definitely plausible. Yeah. Okay. I haven't read anything about that, but that's sure. Yeah, Steve?
Yeah.
So you say these researchers developed a new kind of battery that they can fill as quickly as someone could fill a tank of gas. So within like 10 minutes, they can fill up this battery.
What gas pump are you going to?
My question to you is, does this battery have the same... Could the car go as far on that battery recharge as it could on a regular tank of gas?
Probably not.
That's really cool. I hope that one is true. That means that a breakthrough has happened. And I'm sure it's plausible. And I know tons of people are working on that. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the last one, this one, I hate anything that lives off of anything else in this manner, but a plant that grows in the flesh of living animals. I could totally believe that, too. And that's disgusting, and I hate that. I'm going to say that it's probably the battery one that's the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Well, the spider species predominantly eating vegetables instead of animals. Yeah, that's interesting and very plausible, I think. I can't think of why that wouldn't happen, you know, other than the fact that I guess most spiders eat meat or other insects and so forth. So, but nothing super special going on there. So I think that one's okay. Now this, all right, if there's one thing that listeners to this podcast have learned over the many years, and the subject of batteries comes up often. Batteries take a long time to advance in their technology. They are very small steps in battery technology. As much as we'd like to say there are breakthroughs, and you know this one's going to be 10 times more powerful than this one, it always kind of turns out they're actually small steps that you're making the whole way. And I think we've talked about so many different topics in regards to that, and that seems to always be the case. So this goes against that. And therefore, I'm thinking that one is the fiction.
That's why I picked it, Ev.
Yeah. And then plant species that grows exclusively in the flesh of live animals, that seems really strange.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, they're parasites and they're fungus and you know other things that certainly live within the flesh of animals and other things. So, but a plant species, which is not a fungus, at least I don't think, right, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
That would be quite a discovery. Plus, wouldn't a live animal try to get the plant species off of it? I mean, if it's growing. Unless it's growing on the inside of it somehow. But that would be a parasite. I don't know how a plant could possibly survive inside. It needs photosynthesis. It needs light or some sort of energy to grow. So I'm having a big problem with that one. But then I go back to this battery one, and I'm pretty sure that one's the fiction. But then again, I don't know how plant species could grow in the flesh of live animals. I don't see how that's possible. So I'm just going to have to make a decision, and I guess I'll go with my gut instinct and say that the battery one for the electric car is the fiction, but I won't be at all surprised if the plant species one turns out to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Okay, the herbivorous spider. Yeah, I'm actually surprised that this is the first recorded one. There's so many thousands of different identified species of spiders, but I guess I'm still not having too much of a hard time buying that. I just wonder how it eats the food. Does it still inject the venom, which dissolves the internal parts of the plant and then sucks them in? Is that kind of the same idea? I don't know, but I'll buy that one. The battery that charges quickly as filling a tank of gas. Well, I don't know about that. That's one of the holy grails of battery technology. Even if the range is 100 miles... 150 or 200
or 80 kilometers.
That would be it. Even if it was an 80 mile range that you could charge in 10 minutes, 5 to 10, that's extremely suspect to me. The plant species growing in flesh, that's pretty wicked. I'm not sure. I guess it sounds feasible to me. Evan made a good point about photosynthesis, or maybe it's got a part of its life is outside, and then it kind of goes through a transformation, gets eaten or something, and kind of morphs into its other part of its life cycle, and then it requires to be in flesh. That kind of sounds possible. But the gas electric battery one, I think I would have come across that because that's really huge. So I'm going to say that that is fiction.
All righty. Well, let's take these in order. All right, let's start with the first one. Item number one, scientists discover the first recorded instance of a spider species that is predominantly herbivorous. This one is science.
Mm.
This one's actually been a little widely reported the last few days. Do you know how many different identified spider species there are?
Millions.
It's like 9,000 or something.
I was going to guess 8,000.
40,000.
I was closer.
I was going to multiply my guess by 5 and get 40,000.
40,000. This is the first one that eats plants. This is the Bagheera kiplingi, I guess named after Rudyard Kipling, the occupant of Central America and southern Mexico. And this spider eats the nectar and also parts of the acacia plant. Now, this plant has a symbiotic relationship with ants. The ants protect it from other herbivores, and then the acacia will give the ants, you know, housing and food. That's sort of the symbiotic relationship. Well, the spider cheats the system by taking the nectar meant for the ants and also eats parts of the leaf tips known as Beltian bodies. So he actually eats not only the nectar but actually the leaf tips. Doesn't say anything about injecting venom into it.
Yeah. Completely different, yeah.
So he's cool. he's a nice spider.
It's a nice spider. It's an herbivorous spider. Yeah, not nice to the ants. He's, you know,
right.
Very interesting.
Wonder if it still has fangs even.
I see a picture of it. I don't know. Nothing obvious. If they are, they're very small. Probably they have small ones.
Yeah.
Let's go on number two.
There we go, guys.
All right, I'm down on one knee praying.
Number two, research. Researchers have developed a new kind of battery for an all-electric car that can be recharged as quickly as filling a tank of gas, and that
please,
one,
God, let us be right,
is science.
Oh.
No!
Well, that's actually...
Damn, Evan, we both got nailed.
That's bittersweet.
Yeah,
yeah, but
I'm happy, though.
I said,
tell me all about it, man.
What do you think? How can they do that? How is it possible that you can charge a battery with the size and range for an electric car in the same time it would take to fill a tank of gas?
They have multiple plugs.
Nope. They replace it? They switch them out.
Sort of. They're not replacing the battery, though. They are actually recharging the battery.
Yeah, otherwise, yeah.
This is a redox flow battery. It's a new type of battery that uses a liquid electrolyte as the charging medium.
Electrolyte.
So you can pump out the exhausted electrolyte, fluid electrolyte, and replace it with charged fluid electrolyte. Again, in the time it would take to fill a tank of gas, and you have the battery's fully charged.
Hmm.
I guess some people might complain that you're not actually recharging the electrolyte.
Yeah,
you're just swapping it out, but you are recharging the battery. So I guess there's a little bit of wiggle room
semantics.
There. A little bit of semantics there, but whatever. Don't bother writing it.
Steve, you see, this is where you lose your street cred when you do something like
this. Now, I think this is legitimate. You have a battery. You pull up. The battery's there, and they recharge the battery in 5 minutes because they're swapping out the electrolyte fluid.
Well, how about this? You pull up, and they give you a brand new car with fully charged batteries.
Well, that, you know, come on.
I don't think the question would have read that.
Okay, all right. But this does create the scenario where you can have filling stations that you fill up your battery like you fill up your tank of gas, right?
My questions are: what does it cost to replace the electrolyte, and what's the range of this damn thing?
They don't store as much energy as the lithium-ion batteries. They have about a quarter of the distance of a lithium-ion battery.
Ouch. Ouch! Quarter,
yeah. So you need to have more. You need to have more.
Yeah, you need to have four batteries,
yeah, four times the size. Now, if they could get the capacity up to the lithium ion range, but again, we don't have the battery that has all the features that we want, right?
Right.
You might
have
a battery that has one really stellar feature, but it's weak in other areas. So I don't know. We'll see. This may be a dead end if they can't get the. If they can't get the range up, can't get the capacity up. If they can...
Who developed this?
This is developed by Germany. So it's a German government-sponsored research, and it was researchers from the Fraunhofer Institute for Chemical Technology. Fraunhofer, Jay.
Fraunhofer!
Right. Which means that scientists have discovered a plant species that grows exclusively in the flesh of live animals is fiction.
And that was my that's where I hedged my bet, because I said if the electric car one turned out to be true, that this one would have to be the fiction.
Well, yeah, you're down to 50-50 at that point.
Steve, my guess is that it grows in It grows in the flesh of dead animals.
No. This was inspired by another story completely that I almost used as a real one, but I had three good items. I had to pick one of them to make the fiction. What scientists have discovered is that certain plant species can recognize their own siblings.
Yeah, I read that one.
Yeah, okay, plants that grew from seeds from the same mother plant. And they also discovered how they do this through chemical signatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. How they know that they recognize them is that if you plant them side by side, they will compete with plants that derived from other plants, right? And they will not compete. They will not send out as many roots as they can to soak up the nutrients and water from the soil if they're planted next to one of their siblings. So they'll play nice with their siblings, but they'll compete with plants that are not their siblings. Yeah, it makes sense, right? Kin selection.
Yeah, propagating those genes.
Yeah, it's all about the genes. So I got all of you.
Wow.
That's great.
Yeah, like a... a spider ensnares a fly.
Exactly. Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy from last week.
Yeah, why don't we play it again and give everyone a reminder.
And these service charges, these are scams and ripoffs that the biggest banks and credit card companies are doing, and the U.S. government, the federal government, is allowing it to happen. 30 states.
And that was
so who was
asshole.
That douchebag, Evan?
your favorite jerk and mine, Kevin Trudeau, selling his best talking about his best debt protection or get out of debt free secrets
that they don't want you to know about.
And he's talking about other people than banks and institutions.
Isn't it amazing?
Scam artists.
It's just amazing that this convicted fraud hit upon not only the medical secrets that the medical industry has been hiding from the public, but also the debt reduction secrets that the powers have been...
The government just does not want you to know.
This guy's a genius. I mean, is there anything he can't figure out? I mean, this guy has all this hidden knowledge, and what, just because he's a convicted con artist, does that mean we shouldn't believe him?
Yeah, Steve, doesn't mean he wouldn't have actually found out something like this
it's just
hit
like,
on one of these
things.
You
know, Dennis Lee, convicted of fraud, just happens to go on to discover the secrets to free energy. Right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
What's unbelievable about that?
What will it be tomorrow, you know? Diver?
Convicted frauds often make these breakthrough scientific discoveries.
Because they understand how the world really works.
Right.
The rest
Steve,
of us
what are you trying to get at?
And then sell them to the public through infomercials and pyramid investment schemes.
Are you trying to say that there's anything other than totally goodwill towards humanity happening here?
I'm just saying.
Okay.
Kevin Trudeau.
Evan, what do you have for us this week?
Well, OPCN from the boards guessed it correctly.
Yes, he did.
He did. After some other guesses of, that were incorrect, but Kevin Trudeau eventually was named. Congratulations, OPCN. Should I be pronouncing that Opkin? Or
no, I think OPCN Opsin? Is good.
Okay.
What do you got for this week, Ev?
Yeah, let's see. Let's see what I conjured up for this week. It's not a speaking role, I can tell you that. Well, let's just have a listen. See if you can guess what this noisy is.
Well, I don't like that.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's
some
kind of animal.
That noisy. Possibly, or it's trying to start up that car right. with the battery, with the electrolyte.
The electrolyte battery. Okay, that was a good one, Evan.
It was a good one. So give it your best shot.
All right. Jay, give us a quote.
I got to tell you, I didn't really like Twitter when it came out.
You were not Twitter-pated?
No, and I'm not that crazy about Twitter. I guess it's just one of those things. Like I like more information than 140 characters.
140 kind of is a little, they should increase
number
to 200 or something.
But there's a couple of sites, couple of Twitter accounts that I really like, and one of them is this one called Shit My Dad Says. And this was sent in by a listener named Rob Howe from the UK, but I already knew about this site, but I just wanted to give him credit because he did read a really awesome quote. So here's a quote from this Twitter feed called Shit My Dad Says. The universe does not give a fuck about you. You're a speck in this shit. Shit My Dad Says!
But some guy's dead. I mean, that's a very colloquial way of putting a sentiment that has been echoed by, you know, scientists and thinkers that, yeah, the universe is indifferent to the plight of humanity.
I really believe that this is some old dude running at the mouth.
You think
on so? This Twitter. Yeah, I do. I'm on it right now, and he's quite a brilliant wise ass, and I, you know, recommend people just check it out. I love it.
One quick announcement this week. Jamie Ian Swiss will be taking part in a heavy mental show at 7:30 p.m.
And that's clever.
A science, magic, and skepticism workshop at 1 p.m. to 5:30, which will include Jamie Ian Swiss and DJ Grothy and Chip Denman. This is on October 24th in Washington, D.C. at the AAAS Auditorium. For more information, you can go to ncas.org/OCT24. This is an event co-sponsored by the National Capillary Skeptics and the Center for Inquiry, D.C. Sounds like
Washington.
In Washington. Cool. Sounds like a good time.
And that's where you saw Chuck Yeager.
That's right.
From a distance.
That's right.
And shout out his name. Hey, that's called Full Circle. Yeah,
Jamie's awesome. Anyone that has a chance to go see him, he's a ton of fun, and he's a great magician.
God, he's funny.
We obviously interviewed him very recently, and he was also the MC for our live Nexus event.
I watched him do a half dozen card tricks at, you know, a half a foot from where he was doing the card tricks, and I got to tell you, he's got the skills, man. I mean, I was dumbfounded.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Got the skills.
Yeah, he does. and he's also a very interesting guy to talk to. If you have a chance, go up and talk to him after the show.
Yeah.
He hypnotized me with that spinning wheel.
That's true. I do want to thank everyone also who has sent in, who responded to our call for volunteers last week. We are collating everything. Jay's having some email issues, so he hasn't responded personally to everyone, but we are seeing all of the offers for programmers and artists to help us on our upcoming projects. Keep sending them in. We are collating every single one of them, I promise you. And we will get back to everyone once Jay sorts out his email situation. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Thanks, Steve. You're
Shirley.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Oh, wait.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.